Hello, welcome to Farmgate. I'm Finlow Costain, the chief executive of Farmwell and founder of the Food and Global Security Network. Carbon tunnel vision is a nasty disease and can create a strongly distorted perspective on agricultural land use and food production. This program will help to remedy the condition by showing that land use decisions are complex. I'm joined by Adele Jones, the executive director of the Sustainable Food Trust, and by Ashley Bright, a food systems and sustainability scientist based in New Zealand. Welcome both. Ash, from your perspective, why is carbon tunnel vision a problem?
So I think the main issue is that the focus on carbon or on carbon footprints of food, it's often used as a proxy for environmental or ecosystem impacts. So the environment covers, you know, a load of different things like biodiversity loss, freshwater use, soil erosion, but these don't always get, you know, measured, reported or discussed. And it's also often used as a proxy for sustainability. And sustainability is much broader. It includes, you know, animal well-being, human well-being, as well as ecosystem well-being. And food production, it influences and it's influenced by so many factors. And it's more complex than, you know, just a focus on carbon. By focusing on, you know, just one issue, you know, albeit it's a really critical and important issue, we could make decisions based on our purchasing or our land use without, you know, a complete picture or a complete understanding of what's actually going on.
So we've got this situation where the carbon element is presented as the most important, and often a lot of this other information just simply isn't there. So in terms of being a customer, it's extremely difficult to make an informed choice. Now, Adele, you've been leading on the Global Farm Metric at the Sustainable Food Trust for several years now. Would it be fair to say that your work aims to be the antidote to carbon tunnel vision?
Absolutely. As Ash was alluding to, farming and food systems are made up of a whole load of cycles and dependencies. And actually, you cannot make a decision using one single metric, such as carbon dioxide equivalents, without factoring in the economic implications, the social implications, and of course, the other environmental implications, for example, such as those as nature, water pollution, air pollution, or even things like animal welfare. So we need to start looking at the future of food and agriculture in this much more holistic, complete picture sense.
And before we go into the Global Farm Metric in more detail, I just wonder if we could look at where this problem of carbon tunnel vision comes from, because it's something that's being picked up, you know, quite a lot in social media at the moment. And Ash, it seems to me there's a piece of research by Joseph Poor and Thomas Nemacek, which epitomizes the issue. And I just wonder if you could talk us through that research.
Yeah, so it's a few years old now. It came out in 2018. And it looked at the environmental impact of a wide range of foods. So plant and animal proteins, palm oil, wine, chocolate, fruits, vegetables. And it was significant because it was so large. So it consolidated global data, something like 1,500 life cycle analyses or LCAs on 38,000 farms. And it used one consistent methodology. And this is important because life cycle analyses, you know, globally have used different methods. And so it's been quite difficult to compare between countries or between farms or, you know, between systems. So life cycle analyses are a way to assess the environmental impacts of food over the whole course of that food's life. So from farm to fork or farm to retail shop. And they're basically an inventory of all the inputs that's gone into producing that product, like feed or machinery, and all the outputs. So things like manure, meat, emissions, crops. And then at all the different stages of the supply chain, it records the environmental impacts. So the Poor and Nemacek paper actually looked at five different environmental impacts, but the one that has received all the attention is the carbon footprint. And here for plant and animal proteins, they presented the kgs of carbon equivalents per 100 grams of protein. And then extrapolating sort of at a global level and using averages just for each of the food products, so beef or chicken or milk or tofu, they propose that moving to a diet that reduces animal products could spare something like 3 billion hectares of land and reduce greenhouse gas emissions from food by 49%. And so the media headlines that followed sort of condemned livestock production. And then other sites like Our World in Data, which is a really well-respected data visualization site, picked up the study and has used that for its own graphs and analyses.
So the key challenge with this is the way that that research has been presented, perhaps, rather than necessarily the research itself, the way that in presentation often it's brought back to carbon in particular, but that we're seeing a global average reflected. So, for example, with beef, there's a massive variation between the impact of an intensive or feedlot system versus a regenerative beef production system. So that looks really bad because we have a global average, as opposed to something like chicken, which appears to be really good.
Yeah, that's right. I think it's not exactly that the research itself is that it's just used certain components to tell part of the story. And, you know, that is absolutely not their intention. And, you know, a lot of research has followed on from this, which has picked up on some of these aspects. So just looking at the food product, within the graphs that the paper presents, you can see quite a wide variation in the carbon footprints. But because you've just got beef or chicken or milk and the global average, you can't determine what it is within that product that's causing something to be lower or higher. So you can't see the differentiation between systems of how that product is actually being produced.
And of course, one of the other challenges with the work is that it was produced before Professor Miles Allen published his research around methane and revised the global warming potential metric that's standardly used for assessing the carbon impact of different greenhouse gases. So it's still using GWP 100, which overemphasizes the role of methane, as opposed to GWP star, the revised metric, which shows that methane has a much lower impact in farm systems.
Yeah, that's right. It just used GWP 100. It didn't use GWP star, which would have changed the averages for beef somewhat, for ruminants in general somewhat.
And Adele, why is it that you think this research has been so influential?
Well, firstly, just to say I really respect Joseph Poor and Thomas Nemacek. I think they're great academics. I was lucky enough to spend the day with Joseph to explore his new project, or newish project now, Hestia. So really excited to be working closely with him to hopefully remedy some of these difficulties that we've been talking about by linking up Hestia and the global farm metric. I think it became so popular for a few reasons. Firstly, as Ash said, it was a huge global analysis looking at a whole load of different products. So it really sparked the interest of a lot of people. It also came out of two very reputable institutions, but also because we're always looking for silver bullet answers, particularly the media. They like a headline, and this report really gave them some headlines. In this case, looking at the carbon dioxide equivalents of kilograms of products, and of course, suggesting that beef had a huge environmental impact. And really, saying eat less meat is a bit like saying eat less plants. It's way too simplistic. There's a whole load of variation between different farming systems, and we really need to take that into account in future.
And one of the other challenges is that government likes simplicity as well. So when you have a piece of research that appears to simplify the challenge, and then the media picks it up and amplifies that challenge, there's a danger that the government will say, well, clearly this research is telling us that meat is a bad thing, meat's a bad thing.
Absolutely. And I think the issue with farming is there is a bit of a data gap, to be honest, in terms of the impacts of different farming systems. For example, with grass-based livestock, there's quite a big data gap actually on the soil carbon sequestration potential of, for example, what we call mob grazing, which is where animals mimic through human management the herd instincts of large herds that used to roam the plains of the savannas in North America and Africa, for example. And I think obviously that then isn't factored into government decision making. And so I think we've got a challenge ahead of us and an opportunity, you could say, to fill some of those data gaps so that future decisions, whether it's market-based or policy-based, can take into account this nuance in terms of the different farming systems and the impacts they have.
You talked about the time that you'd spent with Poor and Nemacek, and I wonder, do you think that they're aware of some of the challenges that came out of the work that they did and are aware of perhaps some of the anger towards that work from people within the livestock rearing community?
Yeah, absolutely I do. And I think they completely recognize that using these global averages with huge error bars is actually quite dangerous in terms of decision making. And so they're definitely looking to improve on those models and try and pool as much data as possible to start then looking at different scenarios and playing with different metrics and indicators to see whether that changes some of the results. And so Hestia, as far as I understand it, and I'm probably going to do it a disservice, sorry, Joseph, is basically a huge portal of life cycle analysis data that then uses all the different models that exist, Pore and Nemetschek model being one, but of course the IPCC model being another, and there's plenty of others as well. And it then uses these different models and uses the data to look at different scenarios, basically. So we can start to build up, hopefully, a more nuanced understanding of the impact of these products, these farming systems, different regions around the world.
Ash, one of the metrics that keeps coming up when people are presenting the idea of feed efficiency and that intensively produced food can produce more calories, for example, for less carbon, is the metric of feed conversion efficiency. Can you talk to us about what that is and why that's become important?
Yeah, so feed conversion efficiency or feed conversion ratio, it's often abbreviated to FCR. So it's the basis of a lot of comparisons of livestock systems, and it's also a key input into life cycle analyses because feed is such a large component of life cycle analyses. So species like chicken and salmon, they have much lower FCRs than species like beef, and that's because they can grow very quickly when fed foods like cereals and soy. That is, they convert feed to meat. So it's an input to output ratio based on quantity. So it's an efficiency metric essentially. And it's one of the reasons why livestock like chicken have lower carbon footprints than extensively kept beef. But what it doesn't factor in though is sort of where and how that feed was produced. And there, I guess, there's arguments and value judgments sort of to be made as to things like whether it's okay to import soy from the Amazon to feed chickens or cereals from land that could grow crops to feed humans directly. And how important is the role that cattle have in converting grass that humans can't eat to meat and milk? And I guess that relates back to my earlier point about what systems the animals are raised in and the broader range of impacts that other than carbon, just to get a complete picture.
So is it that the feed conversion ratio really speaks to a challenge that government sees and policymakers see, that they're facing a growing population, that they're facing a climate crisis, and therefore they feel that it's a good thing that they can produce this food faster and more efficiently, but the problem is that it distorts this larger message?
They're just one type of metric, aren't they? So they're just a metric around efficiency, and they are almost always based on quantity of output. So FCR would be the equivalent to yield from crop systems. And they are going to drive intensification because they're looking at this ratio of inputs to outputs. It's through this negative lens, you know, to do reduced harm, essentially.
It seems to me that, you know, once again, this comes back to different visions of land use, and the feed conversion ratio and the life cycle assessment are part of a sort of spreadsheet efficiency that supports land sparing, but which doesn't really work in terms of practical, sustainable, certainly multi-outcome land use.
I guess, you know, as I said, I think efficiency metrics, they are going to drive intensification because they're just focused on the quantity of output. But on a practical basis, for land use, your starting point for the discussion is what land you have. What can you do with that particular area of land, with its climate, with its soil type? And I feel like surely we can be a bit more ambitious than just the quantity of food that we need to produce from that land. You know, it's not just about the least impact of greenhouse gas emissions. You know, maybe a question to ask is what can we do to maximize the benefits across, you know, a wide range of areas? What can we do to maximize the nutrition, maximize the animal welfare from that piece of land, maximize the carbon sequestration and the soil health? And you know, I think if that's the basis for food and farming that's considered sustainable, it might not be so attractive to grow hundreds of hectares of one crop, because we're not just focused on the negatives of reducing our impact. We're looking at how can we maximise the benefits. So maybe growing multiple crops or integrating trees and livestock would produce a better outcome across a broader range.
Now, I'm certain that when Pore and Nemeshek began their research, they clearly weren't setting out to produce something which has been used by companies and corporations to support business as usual. And we've already discussed that the research itself was much more complex than some of the messages that came out of that. But still, I wonder what it is, Ash, about our scientific processes that means that people, academics, probably with good intentions, end up delivering something which is either distorting in and of itself or which lends itself to distortion by simplifications in the way that it's communicated.
Well, the scientific process is about formulating questions and then making predictions, and then you test those predictions, and over time you end up building sort of a body of evidence. But a greenhouse gas emissions life cycle analysis, you know, for example, it ends up being quite a simple model of this incredibly complex food system, because it has to reduce it down to its component parts of inputs and outputs and impacts. And we don't quite yet understand the whole story of how our food production interacts with the ecosystem and all the biological processes that are involved. Yet we need to break it down into these component parts and look at certain factors in isolation. And I think it's worth sort of stepping back, and then you look at the whole picture and you have a holistic framework of issues. And you question, maybe where does that bit of research fit into this holistic picture? What does that piece of evidence tell us? What behaviours or practices is that metric or is that research going to drive? And ultimately, life cycle analyses and carbon footprints, they're just one tool. As Adele said, you know, this research has stimulated an awful lot of debate, and it's not like it's stopped there and nothing else has happened. I was reading a paper just the other day that rather than looking at 100 grams of protein as the output, looked at the quality of the protein. So greenhouse gas emissions per, you know, unit of protein quality. And it came out with different rankings to the Pore and Nemeshek paper. And it was only possible because of the data set that they had and the data set that they produced. You know, so it has been used to stimulate and generate, you know, different research and starting to build that more complete picture.
So there's a degree to which it doesn't matter if the research takes us in a way that's unexpected or a way that seems in and of itself slightly distorting, because that provides an opportunity for future research to pick up on that and make a correction.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, the data set that they have is incredibly useful, and it's, you know, consolidated, you know, just with one methodology. And it's about understanding that it isn't the whole message, that it's just part of the message, and that we just have to keep building our evidence and building our knowledge and not accept that these simple messages that come out in the media are the whole story. There is always more to know, especially when we have such complex food systems and biological processes, you know, at play.
Adele, I'm thinking about the balance between the speed of academic research and the delivery of this process that we're talking about here, and the need for policy to move at a more rapid pace. There seems to me to be a huge disconnect here, that the perhaps slightly sluggish way that the academic community moves, because research takes time and because those natural corrections might take place over a number of years. But you've got governments trying to deal with a number of global crises in a short space of time between elections. Isn't there always going to be this natural disconnect and this challenge for policymakers to deal with?
I think you're right. I think there always will be that challenge and that friction, I suppose, between having peer-reviewed academic research and then needing to make progress on issues. And I think what's needed within policymaking is, I suppose, a practical approach to these sorts of issues, where you're matching up the academic research with what's really happening on the ground. And perhaps in some cases, it might be slightly more anecdotal, that, you know, farmers are saying, look, we've been doing this for years and we're seeing these impacts. It might not have been published in a journal by Oxford University, but you can genuinely see that by implementing certain practices or using different farming techniques, that really serious impacts, hopefully in a positive way, are being had. So I just think policymakers need to be practical, and I've seen that in action. For example, I spent a year working for DEFRA on secondment, and then I spent a year working for the Welsh government on secondment. And I have to say that the way that the Welsh government were making policy decisions was by being very proactive about speaking to farmers on the ground. And I really think that's a much better way of thinking about the future of these new schemes, for example, that are going to support farmers in future. Is matching up the scientific evidence with what's happening on the ground. And there might be a little bit of disconnect, but we shouldn't let perfect be the enemy of the good here.
I wonder if you think that there is a problem when it comes to communicating agroecology and regenerative farming, that we can't just draw a simple graph and say, this is good, this is bad. The Global Farm Metric, for example, has 33 largely outcome-based measures across 11 different categories. And that's not straightforward at all, is it?
Exactly right. And I think this is exactly what we need to move away from, the this is good, this is bad, very binary approach to looking at different farming systems. And so with the Global Farm Metric, we try and take that very holistic view. And it does have 11 categories of assessment at the moment and three key indicators under each one. So you look at it and could feel quite overwhelmed. But our hope is that by trying to collect this data, trying to encourage farmers to engage with this data, it will give us that much fuller picture. And of course, there's different interfaces. Not everyone is going to want to look at all the data. For example, farmers might need to go into much more detailed management data, and a buyer might want to look at a slightly kind of aggregated view of that data when they're making decisions. So we're not saying that every person in the food system needs to understand the, you know, granularity of the Global Farm Metric data, but we are saying that people need to take a holistic view of agriculture when they're making these decisions.
So just talk us through some of those categories and metrics. And if, you know, you're having a conversation with the government or with a food company about how to apply the Global Farm Metric, how do you start to advise them about how they prioritise perhaps different elements of it if they don't want to use the whole thing?
We are trying to encourage them to look at the whole spectrum of categories. What the point I was alluding to is that we're not necessarily saying that everyone needs to go to the same level of detail. But just kind of going back to where the project started, I suppose, because it provides some useful context. We started this project back in sort of 2015, 2016. So quite a long time ago now, pre-Brexit, pre a lot of the net zero commitments that most companies and organizations now have. And it really started with a group of farmers saying, look, we're collecting all this different data or doing all these different audits or assessments each year, whether it's for certification, compliance, for receiving their BPS and stewardship payments, a whole load of different audits that many farmers are subjected to each year. And when we ask them, I suppose, the killer question of, does any of that information actually help you make more informed decisions about how to be better in terms of sustainability each year? The resounding answer from all of them was, no, not really. You know, we might do our certification for whether it's organic or red tractor each year, but it doesn't really tell us if our soil health was any better or worse than it was last year, or our water quality or our animal welfare. And I think that's the type of data that farmers are really wanting to see now. And as you were saying, we need to move away from the black and whiteness of good and bad, and instead look at it as a spectrum, which is, okay, how can we make small steps each year or each month or each day even, which allow us to be better across the spectrum of sustainability metrics? So we basically took that challenge and put it back to the farmers and said, look, what do you all think you should be measuring and reporting on each year? And let's not reinvent the wheel here. Let's use all the existing data points, assessments, audits that already exist and take the best bits from all of them, basically. And so sort of fast forward to where we are now, 6 or 7 years later, we have what we now call the Global Farm Metric. And it's called that because we have aspirations for this to become a globally common framework for measuring farm level sustainability. So far, we've been focusing quite a lot on the UK, and we relaunched the project in 2020 as a coalition. It now has, I think, between 90 and 100 different organisations part of that coalition, all helping us to come up with these common metrics so that we can all use that data in different ways to drive progress in the same direction. So actually, it doesn't really matter if you want to call it regenerative or agroecology or climate smart farming or nature friendly farming. What we're looking at is the impact of those production systems. So what's the soil health score? What's the water quality score? What's the animal welfare score? What's the productivity score? So we're looking at all these different factors as part of a complete picture.
You ended there with the word picture, and I wonder if you're thinking about and looking at ways to present this so that it's easily consumable by the general public.
Yes, yeah, so we see the global farm metric having multiple uses, of course, as I was saying, for farmers to use as more of a management tool. And we're not in the business of creating technology here. We're really focused on the framework. So it's up to the technology providers, who are far better at this than we are, to come up with those applications of the global farm metrics, so say. But we hope it can be used by farmers in future as a management tool. We also see it as an opportunity for governments to understand how and where public goods are being delivered. So we're lobbying government quite hard at the moment to introduce a annual sustainability assessment as a condition of receiving taxpayers' money, something that the Welsh Government have already committed to with their farm sustainability review, which is great. But we're working with DEFRA and undertaking some ELM test and trials, which I very much hope will still go ahead with everything going on at the moment. But it could also be used by food companies and retailers to improve supply chain transparency, and also finance and investors as well. There's a lot of talk at the moment about green financing, green loans, for example, and of course, natural capital investment, even carbon offsets and biodiversity offsets, which I think could potentially be a force for good as long as they're governed by these common metrics. And if that whole system are all using the same metrics to drive change, I genuinely think it could be a game changer in speeding up the transition to more sustainable, more regenerative agriculture. But your question was about disseminating this data for citizens, which I think is really, really important. Ultimately, governments and companies will only act if they feel the heat from the general public. So we need to provide people with this tool, I suppose, to be able to make decisions about the food they're buying, the food they're supporting. And again, we're not in this to try and create a food label here. So we're working quite closely with the Clear Labelling Group to try and lobby for common metrics behind future eco-labels, as they're referred to. So the idea would be that whether you go into Tesco's in the UK or Walmart in the US or Woolworths in Australia, wherever you might be, you'll probably see an eco-label which is branded in a slightly different way, but it will be using the same metrics and the same data behind it. So you can make genuine comparisons between that carrot versus that carrot based on this holistic set of metrics. And as I said, it's currently got 11 categories of assessment. I think they fall quite nicely into three sort of macro categories, which is climate, nature, and health and well-being. And I think if we can give consumers that tool to make decisions based on those three kind of overarching categories, we could be in a much better place in terms of allowing people to understand the relative sustainability of products.
Ultimately, do individual citizens need to take an interest and start understanding the nuance rather than just hearing media messages that meat is good, meat is bad, and reductionist stuff like that? Or is it that the companies that you're talking with will handle that complexity and then these labels will reproduce a simplicity in the marketplace for customers?
I think ultimately it will be both. I think there is a huge interest amongst the general public now about wanting to do things which are going to make a difference. And there's always going to be a subset of the population who want to dig into more detail on this topic. And I think we should allow them to do that by giving them the information they want to see. Even if it means, you know, for example, there could be a QR code where you can go and learn more about the complex data behind some of these farm level assessments. And we do believe this should be coming from the farm up rather than academic models. But at the same time, I think there's always going to be people who would rather for example, the supermarket's choice edit for them. And, you know, Sainsbury's, let's say, look, we want people to know that when they come into our store, there's going to be a degree of quality and transparency about the food that we're selling. I think ultimately it will be a mixture of both, and we need to sort of embrace both approaches. But it's all about honesty, it's all about transparency, and it's all about holistic measures.
Which, to an extent, I guess, Waitrose has done quite successfully just with its Dutchie brand, that it's used the Dutchie brand as a proxy for greater sustainability?
Yes, I think they have. But again, I think they could improve significantly on the transparency of what Duchy really means. And I think there's huge opportunity there to tell a story as well. And I think that's what we need to all get better at doing, is telling stories about these different farm products, because ultimately, that's where you really capture the hearts and minds of individuals.
When we're talking about this issue of nuance versus simplicity, bringing us back to the academic community, scientists, by their very nature, very often take something which is quite big and quite complex, but then sort of try and extract, one element of it so they can research it in detail and answer a more simple question that goes sort of back into the whole. So if the criticism of the scientific process is that it reduces complex challenges down to their component parts and then perhaps fails to rejoin the dots at times, or the communications teams fails to rejoin those dots, then the global farm metric is clearly approaching the land use challenge in the opposite way. So I wonder how academics and policymakers have responded to your work.
I mean, generally pretty positive. In terms of the academics, we've been actually working quite closely over the last 6 months or so to really back up the farm level data collection with scientific evidence, because of course that's always going to be a criticism of, okay, well, if you're asking farmers to collect this data, as we are at the moment, currently the global farm metric is being used as a self-assessment by farmers, that you need to make sure that data is rigorous and credible. So we've been undertaking what we call a Delphi review over the last 6 to 8 months, which is where we put the metrics to a really diverse group of academics and ask them for their opinions about how rigorous these data points are. And so I think it's about matching up the scientific credibility with what farmers need to make useful decisions on farm.
Has the feedback been good?
The feedback has been good. I mean, it's complex, as you can imagine. For example, the biodiversity category took weeks to go through this scientific analysis, and I'm sure we're not finished yet. It's really difficult. We're not saying this is easy at all, but we're only going to achieve it if we work together.
Fantastic. Ash, you've worked with people from across a whole range of supply chains over the course of the last 20 years. Do you see an appetite for moving away from single issue sustainability metrics and towards a more meaningful whole system approach, within those companies and food systems that you've been working in? And from an outside perspective, how practical do you think the global farm metric is for people working in the food system?
Well, I guess as Adele mentioned before, I think there isn't a silver bullet answer, and there's not going to be one key metric and no one right way to do something in all the different landscapes and climatic zones that we have. And with the multiple sort of social and environmental crises that we're facing, I don't think we have any other choice but to embrace this complexity and try and work with it. I think the global farm metric is helping to put, all this complexity into context with these 11 categories. And so whether you're a farmer or whether you're a food business, that, those categories are the same. In terms of measures, I think all you can do is make a start, right? So as Adele mentioned, it's not starting from scratch. You're not trying to reinvent the wheel. You're taking data that already exists from farm management systems, from other audits, and using that. And then so it's building on that and taking it, one step at a time and doing what you can do. And I think honesty is really key in this whole debate as well. Being honest about the fact that it's hard and it's complex and that we haven't really done it before and we haven't approached it like this before in this holistic framework, and we've got, a lot to understand. And honesty that the food systems, making fundamental changes is really difficult, and that this all gives a picture from which citizens can make better purchasing decisions and ultimately help drive that change. It's not going to come down to simple binary good and bad products.
Fantastic. That's been so interesting, and thanks so much to both of you. That's all we have time for. I'd like to thank my guests, Ashley Bright and Adele Jones. If you've enjoyed listening, please come back and listen to more. Tell your friends, like us, review us, and share our links. FarmGate is funded by Sankalpa, and you can join the conversation on Twitter by searching for FarmGate Podcast. I've been Finlow Castain. Bye for now.